The following message by the Reverend Mr. Samuel Emmerich was delivered at 10 a.m. on October 17, 1968, for daily chapel service held in Estes Chapel on the campus of Asbury Theological Seminary. The message was recorded through the facilities of Asbury Theological Seminary and is now made available to you through the seminary's tape library. Additional copies may be ordered by contacting the tape library and giving complete identification of the message. Copyright privileges must be observed, and this message must not be transcribed without the explicit consent of the seminary. Now here is Dr. Stanger to introduce Reverend Emmerich.
It's a great personal privilege and joy to welcome to Asbury Seminary Chapel this morning the Reverend Samuel Emmerich of Richmond, Indiana. For 9 years, I have endeavored to work out arrangements for the Reverend Mr. Emmerich to be with us. There's a little moral here. If at first you don't succeed, try again. Mr. Emmerich is a native of Pennsylvania, a graduate of Asbury College and of Drew Theological Seminary, and holds the earned master's degree from Butler University. For 17 years, he served local pastorates in the North Indiana Conference of the Methodist Church. For the past 12 years, he has served as the executive director of the Yoke Fellow Institute in Richmond, Indiana. It's a great privilege for us as a seminary to have visiting in our midst this international leader in the field of church renewal. And I'm so happy to be privileged to present him to you now as our chapel speaker, the Reverend Mr. Emmerich.
President Stanger's words, I am moved and have been moved with the privilege of being in this place since I arrived yesterday evening. My staying away from this place was not intentional. I must say that actually and very really, it has had more to do with the shaping of my life than anybody could say. I am moved, as I am aware, of one in the audience who knows my life about as well as I knew it in the years that I spent at Asbury College. And seeing him here, remembering those days of quartet miles and all the struggles we went through in our life together, and how well he knows me reminds me of the story of the prisoner who was paroled and back in a town where he established a new relationship where his record was not out. He was leading a service on a Sunday evening occasion, and on that date, one of his buddies came through town, and seeing his name advertised as being a religious leader in one of the meetings, he appeared in the evening service, and he entered the service just as the man was reading the lesson of the evening. And he was so filled with consternation to see a prison buddy come in, lest the community know his past from this stranger, that he had to get a word to him. So at the end of the lesson, he just kept on reading so that the congregation wouldn't understand, but that his buddy would. And his conclusion to the lesson was, "If thou seest me and knowest me and sayest nothing, I will reward thee." And whatever Dr. Ray tells you is to be discounted. I've been hearing since I arrived about the people who have been here. The bishop has come. And I've been hearing about the people who are on your agenda. And I am grateful to know what you are to receive. And as I listened, I had a little of that feeling of that little man, Carlos Romula, who was ambassador to the United Nations from the Philippines, a little man who could stand so tall and so mighty. And on an occasion in a program where he was in between two big men, actually, physically, and the rest, when he got up to speak, he said, "You know, I have some of the feeling of being just like a little thin dime sandwiched in between two big nickels." Those of us who are gathered here today and all who are concerned about the present state of the church knows that the Christian movement does not have all going well for it. And perhaps the introductory paragraphs that I shall say to you this morning are really nothing new at all, but just recalling for us the moment in which we stand and the context where you and I are privileged under God to be present and to be enablers and to serve. I think there are two factors very alarming, not that they should scare us from the battlefield, but make us more prepared. Two factors that seem to be quite alarming. One of them, the fact that in many instances there is evidence of a lost identity in the life of the church. That somehow the awareness of the amazing calling of God to his people has been dimmed. And the clarity and the cutting edge seems not to be felt among us. That kerygma, the substance of the faith, that gives us meaning and that bears us, seems so often to be sadly missing. And somehow we're aware that in places at least, and in some instances, there seems to be theological bedlam among the leaders themselves. The absolutes are being replaced by relativism, and somehow there's an emptiness about the present moment. It is startling. There is a crisis of faith that seems to be on in our midst. We need to know this. We need to know the horizon on which we stand, the perspective in which we do our work. The late Samuel Miller, Dean of Harvard Seminary, I think used a phrase that characterizes it so well when he said there has been a geological fault that has occurred. And I went to our professor of geology at Earlham, because I was certainly not a geological student or a student of geology, and I was talking to him about the meaning of this phrase because it laid hold of me, it caught me. And I became aware of the strata of rock that has moved along a horizontal plane, perhaps for a long time and a long distance, but at some point a fault has occurred, a fracture has come about. It doesn't happen necessarily suddenly, but it might be over a long period of time. And studies have shown that where such fractures and faults have appeared, that the course of the strata of rock has so moved away from its original course and direction that it is actually in some places as much as 30 miles out of its original path. And I began to comprehend what Dr. Miller was trying to say. That somehow when one loses their identity, their reason for existence, the calling that brings them into being, what a pathos, what a sad note this lays upon our hearts. So that somehow there's a need among us to be rerooted again in that history and in the facts of that history and in the relationship that those facts make possible, that have been for the calling and the equipping of God's people to be his people in the earth. The meaning must be restored. The aliveness must again be among us. The joy of identity, the understanding of who we are as God's people. I think I should say another characteristic of the moment seems to be so obvious, and so many people are writing about it. It's not new to you. You sense it maybe in your own life, your own parish, or wherever you root down. The fact of the lost sense of mission, that is what we are for. The self-interest of the institution has occupied our time and our attention. Somehow the structure has become the center of interests, and we have become busy about what seems to be oftentimes just the housekeeping duties of the church, and without a cause. So that very often that clever phrase of the navigator, who when the pilot called out on an occasion said, "How are we doing?" He said, "Well, we're lost, but we're making good time." And I think this is far too often the kind of expression that characterizes our life. We don't know how to be engaged or what we're for when we do discover that we are on the frontiers of the world. And one of the great struggles of the church at present is the crisis of communication, the great gap that exists between us and mankind, so that we do not know how to relate and how to witness and how to be present meaningfully there. And so the conflict is on in the church as to how we're going to get there. There are the immobilists who say we just want to keep everything as it is, and the rigidity that is killing the church sometimes stems from this corner. On the other hand, you have the arsonist who wants to burn the whole establishment down and rebuild it on the next weekend and say, "Let's get rid of the whole bit." Like the young Presbyterian who was taking his exam in preparation for ordination. I don't know if they still do it, but there was a time apparently when in their questioning of the young theologue, they asked several questions, one of which was, "Are you willing to be damned for the sake of the church?" And he had a fill of it by that time and had a ready answer, and he said, "Yes, sir. In fact, I'd be willing for the whole presbytery to be damned for the sake of the church." So that you have the immobilist who wants to keep it fixed just like it is, and you go touching it or tampering with it or rocking the boat, and you've got a warfare on your hand, and I'm not against that kind of warfare. On the other hand, you've got the far-out people who want to get rid of the whole establishment, and they have no sense of conserving values of the past or gathering from the great tradition the life that enables us to stand and evaluate the past, what it has to say to the present, and lead us into the future. And in between is the reformer. Thank God for the reformer who's able to reach to both, to listen to both, to hear both, and to somehow bring them together until maybe a new thing can emerge. But the battle, I say, is on, simply because, and largely because, I don't mean to say simply because I don't think it's simple. I think it's very complex. Because of the crisis that we're now facing and how to be relating and how to get out there. How to have again both the sense of mission and the ways to fulfill it and the forms by which it might be fulfilled. And I'm glad to say that I feel a rising army of Christian men and women who care about these dilemmas that I've mentioned and are determined to see the servant people of God emerge again until, like a mighty army, moves the church of God. There is good reform going on in the life of the church. My bishop, in addressing the anniversary event of our institute to the Oak Fellow Conference on the campus at Earlham a year ago, talked about the wholesome unrest in the life of the church. I'm grateful for the kind of ferment out of which we can really do some serious analysis to examine our heritage and conserve from the past that which needs to be conserved, but let God bring forth the new thing that this moment is calling for, which I can't always predict and therefore is certainly threatening and makes it to be a risk. But I'm grateful for that company of people who are recovering and discovering afresh the incarnation and all that it means to have God care about his world and be in the midst of his world, calling his people not just to come apart, but to go, and finding a way in which the come structures of the church can somehow be brought into balance where they also have the go, the sending aspect about their life, until somehow the visible form of the life and hope of God's people can stand in the midst of the world, not to be kept in the salt cellar, but to be shaken in the midst of common life where perhaps, real inquiry can be kindled in the minds of the world again. Where they can be stirred and disturbed until they ask the question, why? Who are you? Why are you here? What are you doing? And when the world begins to ask the question, we've got some real opportunity of dialogue and some real opportunity for evangelism. Because I'm quite convinced we've been skillful at answering questions that nobody's asking. And this is particularly true when we're talking about the massive secular man that couldn't care less about the church or this theological seminary, and I think that army is going to increase manifold in the next decade. But I'm saying that it might be that a kind of community could emerge again to move into the life of the world where, like that community in which the early church moved, the kind of inquiry and questioning could emerge in which the people of God could give the reason for the hope that is in them. And when we begin to deal with the world's agenda, with the content the church has to offer, I say that will be a tremendous kind of dialogue where we can really witness to our God and King that this is the Lord's realm. Let us reverence Jesus Christ as Lord. Now, I say I believe there is an army of people rising up in whom there is a movement of recovery, where this identity and this sense of mission is being restored among us. I hope, let me underscore that word, I hope that the Yoke Fellow movement is at least a little tributary to that. There are many expressions of it, many names, and we do not know how many, or we do not need to care about that. The Yoke Fellow movement is not an organization that you join. It is a fellowship and movement of concern for the renewal of God's people, their life and mission. They are a people with a discipline. They suffer the same perils that every other kind of group and movement suffer. And you can find all kinds among those who name themselves as Yoke Fellows. But in response to Christ's words, it seems at least there are some people who can get hold of this handle and begin. And that's perhaps one of its values. When Christ called for yoke bearing, he certainly gave us a clue to the importance of getting people out of the spectator role and into the arena of life and be engaged in what he was about in the earth. And if the spectator sport has taken over your church, it may be that this idea will help you to recall people to their right life and their right reason for existence. We hope that it is a tributary to this wide stream of renewal that seems to be moving in the midst of the fermenting life of God's church. It has its general aspects. As I say, we do not know who all find this idea helpful, but it's in many states and across the seas. I remember registering for a conference in Germany at Bad Boll, a lay academy, a German evangelical lay academy, and to my left was a Japanese man, and we were both registering at the same time, and he was telling where he was from, and I was telling where I was from. And when I said Yoke Fellow Institute, he turned to me and said, "Yoke Fellow?" He said, "I'm a Yoke Fellow. I've been a Yoke Fellow for 6 months." He showed me the little yoke pin that he was wearing on his lapel. He was a member of the Senate of the Japanese government, and we were in this layman's conference together. We do not know, and the important thing is not for us to know, but simply to let an idea break loose, which Jesus seemed to use dramatically and dynamically in the midst of his people. And that's one of our reasons. There are two or three ways in which we're trying to do it. One is through a center. A center where retreats and workshops and all sorts of opportunities of involvement are made possible. We worked in an old house on the edge of Earlham College campus for 8 years. Let me say that I came to see the value of this, not because I planned it, not because I went to school to get ready for it, but because a bishop in my area had insight to the possibility and invited a man from each of his 18 districts to spend a weekend in this same old house, which was being readied for this purpose, and I knew nothing about it. And among that group of 18 men was a member of the parish I was serving near Fort Wayne. He was a surgeon. He called me in one day and said, "You know, I've got an invitation from our bishop to spend 3 days talking about religion." He said, "I can't go to that thing. I don't know that much about religion." And he didn't. He was saying a very real truth. He nearly refused to go because it was obviously threatening to him, and yet there was some status in it. After all, you don't get an invitation from the bishop every other day. And he finally consented to go. The bishop himself told me when he asked him to read a lesson, he had to borrow the bishop's testament because, though he was told, he forgot to bring his Bible. When he was asked to say to prepare a grace for the meal, he had to slip upstairs and figure one out because this was not his custom. He was a man, he was invited because he needed it, and I had nothing to do with his invitation, but the bishop's assistant knew him and invited him to share in this event. He came home from the occasion and called me into his office again. He has 30 physicians on his staff, a man whose power and influence for Christ could be manifold. And I began to see already a change in his life, and he said, "You know, that was the darndest experience of my adult existence," and that was an improvement in his language already. And I remember how he kept referring to this experience and saying, "You know, there are more people have to share this." And within 6 months, a dozen young adults and I went to the same place to spend a similar weekend. And there was nothing spectacular particularly about it, except that we spent some time together moving from one idea to another without great distractions or breaks, so that we could move from one step to another in the dynamic of a community in which we began to discover each other. You know, there's so much greeting in the life of the church, but so little meeting. And we began to meet each other. I've seen people, two carloads of people come from the same church, arrive at Yoke Fellow Institute, and they shook hands as they came through the door for the first time. They're even members of the official board. That's a dramatic way of saying that we have too little sense of community, of eyeball-to-eyeball relationship, where there can be developed a kind of knowing and acceptance and unthreatening climate where I can really be myself, a true, honest self, in the company of other caring people who accept me, and in whose caring company of acceptance and love I am born in a new way before Christ. So that at Yoke Fellow Institute, I saw, it was just a house then, and the institute had not begun, but they were getting ready for it and didn't have a director at the time. But I saw in that company of young men, young adult men, from our parish, something begin, a kind of commitment emerge. When they went home, they continued every Monday morning at 7 o'clock, and I discovered that I was being not so much involved in the kind of thing that I had to push and organize, so much as I was being born on in something that gave me myself new joy and a sense of freedom as a participant. And I began to relax and just see something go that I didn't have to push. Now, I think the retreat movement is the kind of movement that, in a sense, can be a launching pad. It can initiate a new beginning for people of a kind of relationship in which reality can appear. There's so much background for the center idea and the retreat center idea. Iona, off the coast of Scotland, since 1938, has been this kind of a center. George MacLeod saw the need of people being gathered out of their structured world to a place apart to look at it objectively, both their faith and their world, and to see the relevance of both, and to return with new meaning and understanding. The lay academies across Germany provide something of this kind of open, free discussion, opportunity of research together and of openness with each other, where people are together long enough that a new idea can get through, where it is not a matter of being told, but a matter of inquiry in which all are participants and working at whatever is being done. Well, I think there was a kind of encounter that occurred there, and I saw a new kind of commitment and involvement that issued a company of men into the congregation that every Sunday morning began to make my own preaching different, my own relationship to the congregation different. The whole climate and tone of the people began to change, and this hadn't been organized by anybody. Gives you a little humiliation to see something so great begin that you aren't responsible for, that you can't claim credit for, that you didn't organize. And so one of the things that we see our purpose to do is to help people to stand where the Spirit is blowing, to use a phrase of Bob Raines. I have a feeling that the retreat movement, one of its values is simply that it helps people to stand where the Spirit is blowing and where they are a little more conducive and responsive, free to respond, free to be, so that conversion, the sense of lay ministry, the laying hold of the life by the word, the eyeball-to-eyeball engagement where men are brought to a new kind of honesty and religious growth and discussion, where perhaps the faith can in a new way begin to become at least intellectually valid and emotionally vivid to the participant, and where the sense of mission can be stirred among us again. Within 3 months, I remember doing a little checking on this group, I discovered, and you shouldn't look for this, it's terrible to even mention it perhaps, but I discovered that there was as much as 120% increase in the giving of those men in the life of the church. Now, if you go out to do this, you know, to make your campaign of stewardship successful, it'll fall flat on its face, and it should. But I'm saying that one of the things we see as a value is a way, whether it's a church camp or a hideout in the hills or wherever, to get people out of the structures of common life where religion has been trivialized and out of the human associations where they have flustered and failed and have been frustrated in attempting to be a witness and have not succeeded, where they can begin to look at both of these with a new perspective and begin to get a local focus that makes sense. And I would say that any seminary community, as well as any congregation represented here, could be greatly benefited. If I was back in a parish tomorrow, one thing that I would certainly strive to do would be to structure from 2 to 4 retreats a year, when I would say to the people, somebody else will be present on this weekend, but I will be with a company of people where we shall be working at some deep levels together. Jesus spent 3 years with 12, and we haven't yet caught the significance of all that we see in that great manifestation there in the Gospels. When people can be together, they sleep in the same place, they eat in the same place, they meet in the same place, and they move. There is movement. And there can be evaluation and a sense of charting a new course. I'm saying I believe in our complex life, we must help people to find a way to restructure their life, to get a perspective in which Christianity makes sense and in which the faith can be kindled and in which their mission can be laid hold of. Well, I could not be a pastor without such an opportunity, because in such occasions the pastor and the layman meet, you see. This old bit of the pastor being 10 feet above contradiction in the midst of his people has to go. And I've got to demonstrate to my people the way it has to go, and the way it can happen is to be able to be with them where we sit together. And eyeball to eyeball, we work together, and the pastor learns to listen to people. This is a perilous thing that we don't know how to listen to our people. I believe it can begin. The retreat can be the time where the pastor discovers that he's got 2 good ears and only 1 tongue, and he ought to discover the ratio of each.
Boy.
To stand where the Spirit blows. Now, the small group often, let me relate the retreat in the small group, because as I see it, one of the values of the retreat is that it launches the group. You don't organize people for this. This is where movements to organize small groups has fallen on its face, because it made a blueprint and it put it out in capsule form and said, this is the answer. And people haven't been discovering the answer because, well, let me say that if it's launched, if there can be a launching pad where they experience what you're talking about, then when you say, can we do this together, it makes sense, because we've already been doing it. And you've got a real point of reference. So let me put the group in that context. I remember the young Texan who said, "Boy, if this is what everybody says it is, do I need small groups? I've got 2,000 members. How do I get 200 of them quick?" And that's where the failure comes in. It's not that kind of a blueprint. And it'll fall on its face like every other gimmick if we work at it from the standpoint of a fadism. But what I'm talking about is the kind of nurturing fellowship which Wesley saw the need for. Whitfield bore his witness that Wesley saw the need for the small fires that kept the faith enkindled week after week in that class meeting of 12 or 15 people. And if Wesley had not seen that and had not brought that into the life of the people and encouraged that kind of nurturing experience, well, it just is highly possible that Methodism would not exist today. Historians like Norwood and others say that is the strength and the source of life, the springs from which our life has emerged. When I think of how people are yearning for reality and meaning and relationship, and that our life together is often more like a rope of sand, you know, there's no connection. And much of our sitting is just like we are here. Everybody's looking the same way. Nobody's looking in the face of each other. Where we really say Jim and know who Jim is. And call for Mary's witness and affirm Mary as being Mary. And what a terrible thing if I should go through a theological seminary and not discover who I am in the midst of a community that affirms me. One of the most dramatic things in the New Testament was a great case in which a demented person came to Jesus running, all the signs of dishevelment and brokenness, crying out, "You get away! Help me!" And the whole confusion of his life poured forth. Now, Jesus didn't say, "Brother, get down and let's pray." Or he didn't say, "Come over to the Bible study tonight." Or "Come to the revival." You know what he said? It's one of the most profound questions I read in the New Testament. "What is your name? Who are you?" And I tell you, if a seminary class or an experience of a seminary community that can discover, help me to discover who I am under God, that's a mission to fulfill. I say to you, there are people who fill our pews on Sunday morning in our churches that yearn for this kind of meaning, and there are pastors who long for this kind of koinonia to exist. We ought to have enough sense to help. I was about to say develop the strategy for it, but that's wrong. To help people to stand where the Spirit is blowing. I could make an argument for this psychologically. I could make an argument for this theologically. Believe me, if you only know how the secular world where your people are involved, if you have a parish where mystery is being crowded out of life and the new science is making man able to do what man needs to do and God just isn't needed anymore, and he probably won't even be hearing your great sermons. But we might find a way in which he can engage in adult inquiry to raise his doubts and questions and be in the kind of company where an honest inquiry can be raised and an honest answer might be explored. So that psychologically and theologically and sociologically, how people live by secondary relationships instead of primary relationships, the whole mobility of our society, the mechanization of our society, this just makes so much sense from every angle you look at it to make possible the nurturing company of interpersonal relationships. Group dynamics has the people in group dynamics has so much to teach us, we ought at least be hearing what they have to say. I say to you that the Word of God has to become the Word of God for me. I don't care how great a preacher you are. It has to become the Word for me. Intellectually valid and emotionally vivid for me. And this might happen if my questions can be listened to. If somebody cares to affirm me who I am and draw me into the kind of participation and articulation where the faith is not up here somewhere on cloud nine, but right here where somebody's going to say to me, what do you mean? Now, what do you mean by that? And we are pressed back to the headwaters, back beneath the shallow verbiage, to the headwaters where we can both stand, needy men, all of us together, in the deep stream of the grace of God. I say I believe it can happen, for in these companies you see there's worship. In many instances, real silence, moments of silence before the majesty and greatness of the great grace of God. There is serious study. There must be serious study if there's going to be a theological spine emerge in the life of the church. There's genuine sharing where the person is really a person and his world is heard. And he is affirmed because he's listened to. And do you know that if you realize that it could be that your greatest ministry to another is to be a good listener? Somebody has said that the greatest thing you can do for another person is to listen him into self-actualization and self-realization. In the process of the group, the sharing, the learning, the mutual support, the eyeball-to-eyeball relationship and inquiry and worship and study. Here is a climate in which the real koinonia can exist, where the person is affirmed as he is listened to and as he is able to respond and be present. Oh, these circles, these companies of people, where honesty and risk and love and liability is present, the masks are laid aside, real men begin to appear. And believe me, that begins to make a different kind of person in the pew on Sunday morning. He begins to listen differently. He begins to comprehend differently. And he begins to have a different perspective in which he's able to put his life in terms of the gospel and of the world. A new openness to mankind begins to emerge. Oh, if I were a pastor, the second thing I would do, I would find a way. I might be a little bit like the Presbyterian lad who says, to hell with some things, you know, but I'm going to see that my life is invested and my ounces of weight is involved in gathering people where the Spirit is blowing. I heard one day, in England, a great nuclear physicist gave his witness, and I wrote him when I got home, to Dr. C.A. Colson, the Roose Ball mathematician at Oxford University. I said, Dr. Colson, I heard you in that address at Bristol allude to something. Will you tell me more? And I cherish his letter. He shared the witness of his life. He said, at Cambridge in my sophomore year, I was in a group of 12 men. So I was kind of drug into it. Thank God for those who drag people in that maybe even aren't ready, but could be. And he said, for the whole year we met, we didn't just meet in that hour of group meeting, but there were ways in which little clusters of us ate together and prayed together in the dormitory and everywhere. He said, that year gathered me up out of my anonymity in a company of caring dozen persons. He said, at the end of the school year, we had a couple of days retreat before we departed for the summer. And he said, as I looked in the eyes of the men with whom I had been with all year, he said, though I grew up in a Christian home, I was on the periphery of the Christian movement. But he said, as I looked in the eyes of the men with whom I had seen such honesty and searching, and we were discussing and trying to put forth what the Christ way was for us that summer, he said, I knew what I needed to do. And that's where my commitment to Jesus Christ occurred. He said, in the 30 years that have passed, I've been trying to put into practice the convictions that laid hold of my life there. A man who has to do with nuclear physics, saying that my life, my attitudes to peace and war, my attitudes to human beings and relationships, all of them began to be formed. That little company of 12 people. I do not know how much we can draw on this story from Abraham, but it says an awful lot to me. It just could be that while you and I are lost in the business of size and statistics and wanting to get the multitudes in, we overlook the possibility that a city could be saved with 10 men who began to plow the channel of faith and purpose deeply enough. In my state, in Elkhart, Indiana, there's a laboratory of medicine, and in magazine medical journals occasionally they have ads, and on one occasion an ad from that laboratory read something like this. It said so much to me. Our laboratories are little rooms where new worlds are made. I believe that kind of little room ought to be in every church. And think of what it means to the pastor himself. What an image is in that 14th chapter of Acts, where Paul had been in Lystra preaching and stirring up the city, and the Jews from Iconium and other places came down and took the people's attention away from him until Paul was actually stoned and left outside the city dead, as dead. If you want to read an interesting interpretation of this, look at William Barclay's interpretation, his translation. This is the word, and I leave you with this. They won over the crowds, and they stoned Paul and dragged him outside the city, for they thought he was dead. But while the disciples stood in a circle, get this picture, while the disciples stood in a circle round him, he got up and went back into the city. I tell you, if you want to be rescued from a dismal life in a parish, from your frustrations and hopelessness, discover the kind of company that will stand round you in a circle of meaning. These are just a couple of ways we're trying to contribute to the stream of renewal. We commend it to you.